welcome to the recordings of the Oldies Literary Lunch at the National Liberal Club, kindly sponsored by Bailey Gifford Actual Investors, who take a long-term approach to investing in exceptional companies.
Our last speaker is one of our leading art historians and art critics. Andrew Graham Dixon has written about everyone from Howard Hodgkin to Michelangelo to Caravaggio, and his latest book is Vermeer, A Life Lost and Found. Ladies and gentlemen, Andrew Graham Dixon.
Thanks, Harry. Hi, everybody. This is a bit difficult to sum up a book in 10 minutes. So, where to begin? Normally, when you write a book about a really, really well-known and much-loved artist, as was the case when I wrote my book about Caravaggio, you expect there to be a fair degree of overlap between what you say and other people in the past may have said. When I wrote the book about Caravaggio, I found myself often in agreement with Walter Friedlander, often in agreement with Roberto Longhi. These were writers who'd said things about Caravaggio with which I agreed. When I finished the very, very, very long process of writing the book about Vermeer, which I began work on in 1998, when I came to the end of that very, very long process, I looked at what I'd written and realised that not anything that I had said about any of his paintings had ever been said by anybody, which is very, very unusual. It's a very, very unusual book. If the book is right, and I'm sure it is right, it means that every other book ever written about Vermeer and every other book ever written about Dutch art is essentially obsolete. This wasn't the intention, but it's the effect. And how did this happen? It's a very odd thing that it should have happened, but Vermeer's case is an odd one. He's one of the best-loved painters, as I said. Proust thought he was absolutely wonderful, thought the View of Delft was the most beautiful painting in the world, which is an astonishing thing to say about a painting of a town. Proust also said that he thought it represented a form of moral purity that was ineffable, which is not so much a quoted aspect of what he said. People go on about the yellow wall, but he said that too. So he recognised something in it. And I think many other people have over the years recognised things in Vermeer, particularly women have recognised things in Vermeer, that writers have simply been unable to explain, scholars have not been able to explain. No answer. He's always been a mystery. And that's often how exhibitions present him. You know, the mystery of Vermeer will never solve it. Which I think is a bit apologetic and a bit of a, you know, rather giving up. But I think that is what had happened. People had just given up. But there were clues. Some of the odd things, for example. Why are all these paintings of women? Why are there so many paintings of women? There are so few paintings, but most of them are of women. Why do they not seem to fit the pattern of Dutch genre painting? Why do they not quite seem to work? A picture of a woman ought to be a kind of patriarchal image. It ought to be a picture of a woman for a man to ogle at, or for a man to regard himself as being superior to the woman, to mock her in some way. She's getting drunk, silly woman. She's giving me the eye, or sexy woman. But the pictures don't seem to fit that, although the attempts have been made often to fit the pictures into those moulds. They just don't work. They don't match it. But in the absence of anybody knowing anything meaningful about Vermeer, speculation was all we had. I began my book in 1998, not long after I'd made a film involving a man called Michael John Montias, who had found out a huge amount about Vermeer, which had been more or less dismissed by Vermeer scholarship. One document in particular he'd discovered, which told us that in 60, which I still think is an amazing thing, 1683, one particular woman, a young woman called Magdalena, died in a house on Delft Market Square. And when the notary went into her house, what did he find? Two-thirds of all Vermeer's pictures, spread into four rooms, including the basement. All of his life's work. in one woman's possession. That was my starting point. Who was that woman? Why did she have all the pictures? Well, she hadn't commissioned the pictures. Her mother had commissioned the pictures. Her mother was called Maria de Knaut, and she was married to a man called Peter Klaas-Zoon van Rauven. Who were they? Was there anything in common between them and Vermeer? So, method. I spent 6 years reading every single archival document touching on them and touching on Vermeer. After 6 years, ding, I found it. They were all Remonstrants and Collegians. They were all members of a particular religious group, a sect, a group of people who believed in religious toleration, who believed in the possibility of world peace, who believed in the idea that Catholic and Protestant and the different denominations of Protestant could be brought together and made to live in peace with one another. Another 4 years, just read Remonstrant literature, just understand how these people think. At the end of that period, bang, all Vermeer's paintings suddenly make sense. They're all pictures of what the Remonstrants and the Collegians believe. Every single one of them. Every single one of those pictures touches on an aspect. The view of Delft, as Proust intuited, is indeed a vision of the New Jerusalem, which the Collegians said, if you want to see the New Jerusalem, don't expect it to come out of the sky like it does in the Bible. The New Jerusalem, it is your own hometown. When everyone's made peace with each other, when the storm has just passed over the world, it's your own hometown. It could be Maresfield, it could be Bexhill, it could be Delft. Doesn't matter. That's what heaven on earth looks like. They're all women, the Remonstrants and the Collegians, 80% women. They meet in Maria's house, these women. They defy the patriarchal Calvinists who say that women should not meet and talk about God. Women should keep quiet about these things. They revere Mary Magdalene. Why? Because Christ showed himself to Mary Magdalene. And if she had kept quiet, no one would know about Jesus Christ's resurrection and the religion we call Christianity wouldn't exist. So don't tell us to keep quiet. What did Maria de Knaut call her daughter? Magdalena. Famous painting called The Girl with the Pearl Earring? Portrait of Magdalena as Mary Magdalene. At the moment when she's turned away, no one can help her. This guy in the garden, he doesn't have a clue. Mary, she turns around. It's Jesus. That's the painting. Each and every single painting, this sort of set of Remonstrant clues that we've established, reading all the Remonstrant literature, it's like having a very big bunch of skeleton keys which just open one Vermeer painting after another. And I'll end by saying that, well, I'll tell you a story, but since I've written the book, people who really work hard in the Dutch situation, people who are like at the rock face of the Dutch archive, the Delft archive, they have taken my side, and they have found, so far, 35 new pieces, and really good pieces of archival information are hard to come by. Only 5 have turned up in the last 20 years. I only found 1. They've found 25 more pieces of information, all of which substantiate the whole thing. When I'd finished writing the book, a friend of mine rang me up. The one thing I hadn't managed to do was to locate the house where all Vermeer's paintings hung. I'd written a whole book about Vermeer the Remonstrant, Maria the Remonstrant, Peter the Remonstrant, all of this. And he said, this guy agreed to help me, and he said, I found the house. He was from Rotterdam, and he'd been to the Delft house archive, which is very, very hard to read and to penetrate, for me anyway. And he said, I found the house. I found the house where all the pictures hung. You'll be pleased. I said, right, okay, so it's not next to the synagogue. He said, no, come with me. We went. It's the porter's lodge of the secret Remonstrant Church in Delft. I found that out after I'd written the whole book. So, should I stop? Okay, I'll tell you one final story. Laura Freeman wrote a fantastically generous review in the Times of my book, in which she said, "This is it, finally, we understand Vermeer, what a revolution, most revolutionary book about any major artist ever been published in the history of art history. Thank you very much." But, she said, "Andrew goes too far. Lace maker." He says the lace maker, that wonderful little picture in the Louvre, he says that's a picture. She's pregnant. And the lace, the cushion, the sewing cushion, which is covered with these red threads, Andrew says that's the image of her placenta, pulsing with blood, just, and this baby is being fed within her. This, apart from anything else, he could only have painted that picture if he'd understood Harvey on the circulation of the blood. Harvey is published in Frankfurt in 1627. How can Vermeer have known about that? Harvey is published in Latin. Vermeer can't read Latin. In my book, I said, well, he would have had it from Spinoza, who knew Henry Oldenburg of the Royal Society, so it could have passed through that method. Anyway, no, guy writes to me from Holland, says, my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, he was Vermeer's preacher, found him in the archive, Nicholas Assendelft. Not only was he a preacher, not only was he Vermeer's preacher, not only did he live in the house with the people, he was a surgeon. And he was the first man in Western Europe to translate William Harvey, not into English. That wouldn't happen until 5 years later. He translated William Harvey into Dutch in Delft in 1652. And he was Vermeer's preacher. Bang! Thank you very much.
This week's podcast was kindly sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors, who take a long-term approach to investing in exceptional companies.